Good day, Sun Sound listeners. This is Janet Martin. I'll be reading portions of the Arizona Daily Star. It is Wednesday, November 27th, 2024. Trump threatens 25% tariffs. If Donald Trump makes good on his threat to slap 25% tariffs on everything imported from Mexico and Canada, the price increases that could follow will collide with his campaign promise to give American families a break from inflation. Economists say companies would have little choice but to pass along the added costs, dramatically raising prices for food, clothing, automobiles, booze, and other goods. The Republican president-elect floated the tariff idea, including additional 10% taxes on goods from China, as a way to force the countries to half the flow of illegal immigrants and drugs into the U.S. But his post Monday on Truth Social threatening the tariffs on his first day in office could just be a negotiating ploy to get the countries to change behavior. High food prices were a major issue in voters picking Trump over Vice President Kamala Harris, but tariffs almost certainly would push those costs up even further. For instance, the Produce Distributors Association, a Washington trade group, said Tuesday, tariffs will increase prices for fresh fruit and vegetables and hurt U.S. farmers when other countries retaliate. Tariffs distort the marketplace and will raise prices along the supply chain, resulting in consumers paying more at the checkout line, Association President Alan Singer said. Mexico and Canada are two of the biggest exporters of fresh fruit and vegetables to the U.S. In 2022, Mexico supplied 51% of fresh fruit and 69% of fresh vegetables imported by value into the United States, while Canada supplied 2% of fresh fruit and 20% of fresh vegetables. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who talked with Trump after his call for tariffs, said they had a good conversation about working together. This is a relationship that we know takes a certain amount of working on, and that's what we'll do, Trudeau said. President Claudia Sheinbaum suggested Tuesday that Mexico could retaliate with tariffs of its own. Sheinbaum said she was willing to engage in talks on the issue, but said drugs were a U.S. problem. Before the election, about 7 in 10 voters said they were very concerned about the cost of food, according to AP VoteCast, a survey of more than 120,000 voters. "We'll get them down," Trump told shoppers during a visit in September to a Pennsylvania grocery store. The U.S. is the largest importer of goods in the world, with Mexico, China, and Canada its top three suppliers, according to the most recent U.S. Census data. People looking to buy a new vehicle would likely see big price increases as well, at a time when costs have gone up so much they are out of reach for many. The average price of a new vehicle now runs about $48,000. About 15,000 of the 15.6 million new vehicles sold in the U.S. last year came from Mexico, while 8% crossed the border from Canada, according to Globa data. Much of the tariffs would get passed along to consumers unless automakers can somehow quickly find productivity improvements to offset them, said C.J. Finn, U.S. automotive sector leader for PwC. That means even more consumers would potentially get priced out, Finn said. Hardest hit would be Volkswagen, Stellantis, General Motors, and Ford, Bernstein analyst Daniel Roskitz wrote Tuesday in a note to investors. A 25% tariff on Mexico and Canada would severely cripple the U.S. auto industry, he said. The tariffs would hurt U.S. industrial production so much that we expect this is unlikely to happen in practice, Roskitz said. It is not clear how long the tariffs would last if implemented, but they could force auto executives to move production to the U.S., which would could create more jobs in the long run. However, Morningstar analyst David Winston said automakers probably won't make any immediate moves because they can't quickly change where they build vehicles. Millions of dollars worth of auto parts flow across the borders from Mexico and Canada, and that could raise prices for already costly automobile repairs, Finn said. The Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S. said tariffs on tequila or Canadian whiskey won't boost American jobs because they are distinctive products that can only be made in their country of origin. In 2023, the U.S. imported $4.6 billion worth of tequila and $108 million worth of mezcal from Mexico and $537 million worth of spirits from Canada. Tariffs on spirit products from our neighbors to the north and south are going to hurt U.S. consumers and lead to job losses across the U.S. hospitality industry, it added. Electronic retailers Best Buy said on its third quarter earnings conference call that it runs on thin profit margins. So while vendors and companies will shoulder some increases, Best Buy will have to pass tariff costs on to customers. These are goods that people need, and higher prices are not helpful, CEO Corey Barry said. Walmart also warned last week that tariffs could force it to raise prices. Tariffs could trigger supply chain disruptions as people buy goods before they are imposed and companies seek alternate sources of parts, said Ron Hanfield, a professor of supply chain management at North Carolina State University. Some businesses might not be able to pass on the costs. It could actually shut down a lot of industries in the United States. It could actually put a lot of U.S. businesses out of business, he said. Israel approved a United States-brokered ceasefire agreement with Lebanon's Hezbollah on Tuesday that would end nearly 14 months of fighting linked to the war in the Gaza Strip. The ceasefire would mark the first major step towards ending the region-wide unrest triggered by Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7, 2023. But it does not address the devastating war in Gaza, where Hamas still holds dozens of hostages and the conflict is more intractable. Hours before the ceasefire with Hezbollah was to take effect, Israel carried out the most intense wave of strikes in Beirut and its southern suburbs since the start of the conflict and issued a record number of evacuation warnings. At least 24 people were killed in strikes across the country, according to local authorities. As Israel signaled its aim to pummel Hezbollah before the ceasefire took hold at 4 a.m. local time Wednesday. Another huge airstrike shook Beirut shortly after the ceasefire was announced. There appeared to be some lingering disagreement over whether Israel would have the right to strike Hezbollah if it believed the militants had violated the agreement, something Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insisted was part of the deal, but which Lebanese and Hezbollah officials have rejected. Israel's security cabinet approved the ceasefire agreement after it was presented by Netanyahu, his office said. U.S. President Joe Biden, speaking in Washington, called the agreement good news and said his administration would make a renewed push for a ceasefire in Gaza. United States President-elect Donald Trump vowed to bring peace to the Middle East without saying how. The Biden administration spent much of the year trying to broker a ceasefire and hostage release in Gaza, but the talks repeatedly stuttered to a halt. Still, any halt to the fighting in Lebanon is expected to reduce the likelihood of war between Israel and Iran, which backs both Hezbollah and Hamas, and exchanged direct fire with Israel on two occasions earlier this year. Arizona will resume executions perhaps as soon as early as 2025, officials say. The decision by Attorney General Chris Mays came after Governor Gady Hobbs dismissed on Tuesday the retired federal magistrate she'd hired in early 2023 to review the process the state uses to put condemned people to death. May said she was waiting on that report before seeking any death warrants from the Arizona Supreme Court. David Duncan has not finished his work, for which he was authorized to charge $175 an hour up to $100,000. But Hobbs, in a letter to him obtained by Capital Media Services, told Duncan she no longer has confidence in him, saying his reports to her show he has gone far afield of her request to review the protocols and procedures used to put inmates to death that in the past have sometimes resulted in botched executions. In fact, the governor noted, Duncan at one point suggested the Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry should consider using a firing squad, says that it does overcome the impediments to lethal injection from unavailability of material and skilled personnel. That, however, is not even an option under Arizona law. So Duncan will get just $36,000 for the work he has done. But Hobbs said Duncan's failing to do what she asked is just part of the reason she's concluded the state is now ready to resume executions for the first time in 2 years. She said Ryan Thornell, her choice as director of the Corrections Department, has now completed his own review of the execution process. That report, obtained by Capital Media Services, lays out a series of changes from revised training requirements to extensive documentation of all aspects of the process. With these changes in place, ADCRR is prepared to conduct an execution that complies with the legal requirements if an execution warrant is issued, the Democratic governor said. Mays, also a Democrat, said Tuesday she will now seek a warrant to execute Aaron Grunches within the next 2 weeks. He was on schedule to be put to death last year when Hobbs asked Duncan to study the issue. Mays agreed to pause the process until that was complete. Grunches pled guilty to first-degree murder and kidnapping in 2002 death of Ted Price, his girlfriend's ex-husband, in the Phoenix area. He waived his right to post-conviction review and in November 2022 filed a motion on his own behalf seeking an execution warrant, but Grunches withdrew that request in January 2023 after Hobbs took office. The Supreme Court refused to reconsider. But the warrant, which has a fixed time limit, expired before the execution was carried out, and until now, Mays has refused to seek a new one. There are 25 families out there who have an expectation that the killer of their loved ones will be executed, Mays said. People with HIV who needed a kidney or a liver transplant will be able to receive an organ from a donor with HIV under a new rule, U.S. health officials announced Tuesday. In an angry outburst in New York courtroom, Rudy Giuliani accused a judge Tuesday of making wrong assumptions about him as he tries to comply with an order requiring him to turn over assets to two former Georgia election workers who won a $148 million defamation judgment against him. Outgoing Democratic North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper vetoed legislation Tuesday that would strip powers from several Democratic elected to statewide offices this month, including removing the authority of Cooper's successor to appoint the State Elections Board. The Conference Board, a business research group, said Tuesday that its consumer confidence index ticked up to 111.7 this month from 109.6 in October, as Americans' outlook on the economy improved modestly. Brazil's former far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, was aware of the activity and participated in a coup plot to remain in office after his defeat in the 2022 election, according to police report unsealed Tuesday. And if you remember, he was a friend of Donald Trump and moved to Florida. The top court in Hong Kong upheld earlier rulings Tuesday that favored subsidized housing benefits and equal inheritance rights for same-sex married couples, a landmark victory for the city's LGBTQ+ community. The United States Postal Service might have found a way to unite a nation bitterly divided after this month's election. It will release a Betty White stamp. The beloved actor, known for roles in The Golden Girls, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Boston Legal, and others, will be on a 2025 Forever stamp, USPS announced this past week. White died in late December 2021, less than 3 weeks before her 100th birthday. The Postal Service hasn't announced a release date for the stamp. An icon of American television, Betty White, 1922 to 2021, shared her wit and warmth with viewers for seven decades, the Postal Service said in announcing the stamp, which depicts a smiling White based on a 2010 photograph by celebrity photographer Kaku Alston. The comedic actor, who gained younger generations of fans as she entered her 90s, was also revered as a compassionate advocate for animals. Boston-based artist Del Stefanos created the digital illustration from Alston's photo. I'd love to send a letter back to my 18-year-old self with this stamp on it and tell him that everything is going to be okay, Stefanos posted on Facebook. Regardless of personal politics, self-proclaimed supporters of Republican President-elect Donald Trump and Democratic Vice President Kamala Harris reacted with delight on social media. Betty White was my hero all my life. I actually had a doll when I was a little girl named Betty White, one Trump supporter posted on X, formerly Twitter. Something to make this awful week a little bit better. We're getting a Betty White stamp, a pro-Harris X account posted. White combined a wholesome image with a flair for body jokes. Her television career began in the early 1950s and exploded as she aged. The only SNL host I ever saw get a standing ovation at the after party, Seth Meyers posted on Twitter after her death, a party at which she ordered a vodka and a hot dog and stayed till the bitter end. An FBI agent charged in Maryland with sexually assaulting two women contacted his alleged victims through social media with a promise to give them free tattoos and modeling work, police said Tuesday, as they encouraged other potential victims to come forward. Neither woman knew that their alleged assailant, Eduardo Valdiva, was a FBI agent, Montgomery County Assistant Police Chief Nicholas Augustine said during a news conference. Valdivia, 40, sexually assaulted the women, both of whom are in their 20s, during photo shoots at a tattoo studio and at a hotel, police said. Both women told police they feared Valdivia would have caused them more harm if they tried to resist or leave, according to a police affidavit. Police detectives suspect he may have sexually assaulted other women under similar circumstances, according to the assistant chief. A state district court judge ordered him jailed without bond Tuesday. The FBI suspended him pending the conclusion of the police investigation. Egg prices are rising once more as a lingering outbreak of bird flu coincides with the high demand of the holiday baking season. But prices are still far from the recent peak they reached almost 2 years ago. And the American Egg Board, a trade group, says egg shortages at grocery stores have been isolated and temporary so far. Those are being rapidly corrected, sometimes within a day, said Emily Metz, the Egg Board's president and chief executive officer. The average price for a dozen eggs in U.S. cities was $3.33 in October, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That was down slightly from September and down significantly from January 2023, when the average price soared to $4.82. But it was up 63% from October 2023, when a dozen eggs cost an average of $2.07. Sometimes supermarkets may be to blame for price spikes. During testimony in August to the Federal Trade Commission, case seeking to block Kroger's merger with Albertson, Kroger's senior director for pricing acknowledged the company has raised the cost of milk and eggs beyond the levels of inflation. But there are several other factors behind the price increases, Met said. The egg industry sees its highest demand in November and December, for example. You can't have any holiday baking, your pumpkin pie, your stuffing, without eggs, she said. Avian influenza is another big reason for the higher prices. The current bird flu outbreak that began in February 2022 has led to the slaughter of more than 111 million birds, mostly egg-laying chickens. Anytime the virus is found, every bird on a farm is killed to limit the spread of the disease. More than 6 million birds have been slaughtered just this month because of bird flu. There was a relatively small part of the total U.S. egg-laying flock of 377 million chickens. Still, the flock is down about 3% over the past year, contributing to a 4% drop in egg production, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The latest wave of bird flu is scrambling supplies of cage-free eggs because California has been among the hardest-hit states. California, Nevada, Washington, and Oregon all require eggs sold in their states to be cage-free. We're having to move eggs from other areas of the country that are producing cage-free to cover that low supply in those states because those states only allow for cage-free eggs to be sold, Met said. Cage-free requirements are set to go into effect in Arizona, Colorado, and Michigan next year and in Rhode Island and Utah in 2030. Demand for such specialty eggs may also be a contributing factor to avian flu, which is spread through the droppings of wild birds as they migrate past farms. Allowing chickens to roam more freely puts them at greater risk, said Chad Hart, a professor and agricultural economist at Iowa State University. It's really hard to control that interaction between domesticated birds and wild birds, Hart said. Some of those vectors have been opened up because we're asking the egg industry to produce in ways that we didn't ask them to before. Met said climate change and extreme weather are also blowing some wild birds off course. We have birds that have been displaced by hurricanes, by wildflowers, and the fires, and those birds are now circulating in areas that they otherwise might not circulate, or at times the year that they otherwise might not be circulating, she said. And those are all new variables that our farmers are having to deal with. Hart said the egg industry is trying to rebuild the flock, but that also can limit supplies since farmers have to hold back some eggs to hatch into new chickens. Still, there is some good news on U.S. poultry farms. The price of chicken feed, which represents 70% of the farmers' cost, has fallen significantly after doubling between 2020 and 2022, Hart said. Speaking of bird flu, a second bird flu case reported in Arizona this month. Poultry in the backyard flock in Maricopa County tested positive for bird flu on November 21st, according to a joint release from the Arizona Department of Agriculture and the Arizona Department of Health Services. The owner reported signs of illness in their flock to the Sick Bird Hotline in order to mitigate the risk of spread. Samples sent to the National Veterinary Services Laboratory for testing confirmed positive shortly after that. This is the second reported bird flu outbreak in Arizona within the last couple of weeks, with the other coming from a commercial farm in Pinal County on November 11. There have been no other confirmed cases of bird flu in the state. Maricopa County Supervisor Clint Hickman, Vice President of Marketing and Sales for Hickman's Family Farms, told the Arizona Republic that he did not know about the outbreak in Maricopa County. Thankfully for our farms in Maricopa County have not been infected with the avian virus, Hickman said. Hickman's Family Farms is Arizona's largest egg producer. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the risk of general public is low. Those most at risk of exposure are people directly involved with the daily care and husbandry of the birds. ADHS is collaborating with AZDA and the local health departments in the response to avian virus influenza and will continue to monitor influenza activity in Arizona in collaboration with local health departments. If you see signs of illness in your poultry, because a lot of people do have their own chickens, report them immediately to the USDA at 1-866-536-7593. Again, that's 1-866-536-7593. 536-7593. You can also contact your local cooperative extension office, local veterinarian, or your state veterinarian. For wild bird illness, please contact the Arizona Game and Fish Department. An annual state review shows more than 850 Arizona children died last year, and nearly half of those deaths could have been prevented. Although the majority of the 853 deaths were classified as due to natural causes, such as congenital conditions or disease, the report focuses heavily on preventable deaths. It notes that 49% of the fatalities could have been avoided. Motor vehicle crashes led the preventable category with 81 fatalities, followed by 68 firearm-involved cases. Those 68 deaths are up compared to last year's total of 59, contributing to a trend line that shows a staggering 171% increase in such fatalities over the last decade, the report noted. The next highest category was suffocation, often due to sudden unexpected infant death syndrome, at 65. The report's authors highlighted the decade-long leap in firearm deaths to draw attention to what they say is a solution: keep guns out of homes where children are present. The presence of firearms in a household increases the risk of suicide among adolescents, they wrote, in 44% of the deaths due to firearms. The firearm user was a child, the report noted. Tim Steller writes, "Let voters decide on fare-free transit." To start off their last study session, city officials came to the mayor and council's table and offered a menu of unappetizing options to pay for fare-free bus rides. A new tax on rental cars would require a change in state law for this purpose. So would the formation of a special taxing district, as would other options. Probably not going to happen. We could raise the hotel motel surcharge or the tax on public utilities, but those are already among the highest rates in the state. We beg the University of Arizona, Pima Community College, and the state's districts, but they're under no obligation to help out, even though they do benefit heavily from free transit. The mayor and some members of the council considered the whole topic at the November 19th meeting to be premature, and it seemed, to my ear, annoying. "I agree that we shouldn't even be having the discussion about fares at this moment," council member Lane Santa Cruz said, supporting Mayor Regino Romero's earlier comments. "This mayor and council have stated time and time again their support of it. We should be talking about financing of transit more holistically, sorry. The review of options left the impression that there is no easy way for covering the estimated $10 million per year cost of not charging fees for bus and streetcar rides. But that's not really the case. There are more appetizing alternatives. Next year, there are two tax elections, one for Tucson voters and one for all Pima County voters, that could absorb this cost. That way, too, voters could have a chance to weigh in on whether we want to pay for the idea. It's something Tucsonians talk about, perhaps because they think fares used to cover most or all of the cost of transit before the city went fare-free in 2020. That's not true. Fares only cover a small portion of the cost of the transit system in the times before the pandemic funding from the federal government allowed the city to go fare-free. Fares covered around 10% of the cost of the entire transit system when Tucson decided to start covering the cost itself in 2023. At that time, the cost of not having fares was about $9.1 million, the city estimated. Last week, city manager Tom Thomu estimated the cost of not charging fares at $10 million to $13 million per year. This is much higher than what some transit advocates think because, among other things, charging fares anew is likely to depress ridership considerably, and it costs money to reinstall and operate a fare system. City Council member Paul Cunningham told me he thinks the cost of not charging fares could be as low as $5 million a year, depending on factors such as how high fares would be set if they ever came back. But he acknowledged he hears about the issue a lot from people who think the program costs more than it does, or that it is responsible for the spread of homeless camps around the city. I don't think we need to do all of those things, Cunningham said. The general fund has absorbed significantly the fare-free transit. It's true, as noted in the study session, that the cost of fare-free transit is accounted for this fiscal year and probably next year going through June 2026. I'm with Romero and others on the council in liking fare-free transit overall. It's incredibly simple. The key, and usually safe and reliable, though it's true that a lot of street people, some of them on drugs, use the system. That probably makes some car drivers uncomfortable, though they should consider the threat of a serious car crash in their risk assessments. What I found disappointing is that not as many people use the bus as I would expect, considering it's free. Although Romero has said at the council and in an email that we have seen record numbers of riders, that's not the case with the bus. Ridership topped 19 million for four consecutive years between fiscal year 2012 and fiscal year 2015. Last year, ridership didn't even top 60 million rides, winding up at about 15.8 million, according to preliminary figures. I want to see ridership return to the numbers of a decade ago. To pay for the free fares beyond 2026 and drive ridership, though we could have a source for the extra millions if the mayor and council would simply put in packages that voters are already considering. The first vote on a half-cent sales tax is scheduled for March. The details of Prop 414 haven't been finalized, but council members are pretty committed to the priorities, its funding, and are likely to approve something close to what's already being proposed. That means most of the estimated $80 million per year the tax would produce would go to Tucson police and fire and related services if the proposition passes. For example, $2.7 million per year would go to non-patrol vehicles for the Tucson Police Department. $1 million per year would go to community-based violence intervention programs. In the housing arena, $4 million per year would go to housing resiliency to help low-income homeowners and renters, as well as add new stock to city-owned housing. Another $3.5 million per year would go to expanding low-barrier shelters and extending the city's Housing First program. You may think these are higher priority items than fare-free transit, but as Romero said, we've got to see free transit as part of a safe and vibrant city. There's no reason city officials couldn't scratch out, say, $5 million of the $80 million per year they're dreaming of to help pay for fare-free transit over the next 10 years. Alternatively, the RTA Next program, the continuation of existing half-cent sales tax, will be voted on by all county voters in November. It includes $610 million over 20 years, or an average of $30.5 million per year for mass transit. Hard to believe a few million of that couldn't go to ensuring fare-free transit. I want to get to the point where we brag about our public transportation system being free and encouraging more people to use it, Santa Cruz said. I agree. And if we could put $5 million to $10 million per year into those tax elections for fare-free transit, we wouldn't have to think about it again about fares for 10 to 20 years. Then we could stop talking about it as much of the mayor and the council seem to want, and focus on maximizing the number of people who could ride the bus. Tim Steller can be contacted at tsteller@tucson.com or 520-807-7789 or on Twitter at Timothy Steller. Opinion page, Bloomberg News opinion. Trump should make building homes great. President-elect is real estate developer with experience overcoming tedious bureaucracy. Most Americans from both parties say the government needs to increase the supply of affordable housing. For President-elect Donald Trump, that should offer a good opportunity to summon his instincts for development and self-promotion to get America building again. Call it the Trump building boom. The problem is clear. For more than a decade, housing construction has failed to keep up with U.S. population growth and household formation. This has helped drive a nearly 50% increase in the median sales price of houses and a similar jump in rents, outstripping the 18% gain in real median household income. The income required to afford a new single-family home is now almost twice what it was 5 years ago, and nearly half of the renting households spend more than 30% of their income on rent. Normally, rising prices should spur construction, and that is starting to happen. But why not faster? For one thing, in many of the cities with the most severe housing shortages, local zoning restrictions, land use regulations, rent controls, affordable housing mandates, and permitting requirements limit development. Sustained attention to complex problems does not come naturally to Trump. But as a second-generation real estate developer, he has had plenty of personal experience with bureaucratic obstacles and political opposition that housing plans often encounter. This might offer him an advantage in helping the U.S. build the estimated 2.5 million homes the country needs. Success would depend on three things. First, the administration should encourage a wave of rezoning and deregulation at state and local levels, which is the source of most of the friction. In his first term, Trump established a council to study the problem. This time around, he should act on its recommendations, including by helping local governments dial back costly requirements such as parking minimums and minimum lot sizes and speed up permitting. More prosaically, the administration should change federal policies that needlessly raise the cost of construction. That could include reducing certain tariffs, such as those on Canadian lumber, which were sharply increased during the Biden administration, as well as expediting environmental reviews and reducing red tape to help address the 288,000 job openings in construction. Trump could create incentives for community colleges and vocational schools to provide relevant training and offer more visas for qualified immigrants. Finally, Trump has promised to reduce interest rates. A commitment to respect the Federal Reserve's independence would cost him little but help a lot. So, might a pledge to cut spending and to moderate many tax cuts he has talked about? Providing an ample supply of housing and making life more affordable should be the goal of every policymaker. Trump will arrive in office with an opportunity to achieve that goal. Build, baby, you might say. Kathleen Parker from the Washington Post writes, "Escape monkeys might be sending us a message. When 43 monkeys escaped from a South Carolina research facility on November 6, countless human cousins around the country cheered them on. No one likes to think about the 70,000 monkeys per year that wind up in U.S. research laboratories for drug and other experiments. Thus, when the 43 young female rhesus macaque primates managed to escape their captors this month, animal lovers enjoyed a shared moment of rare grace. All we needed was Morgan Freeman's God voice reporting the primates' progress along the low country's expansive treetops. Alas, such hopes were quickly dashed. All but four of the monkeys have been captured and returned to their unnatural habitat at Alpha Genesis Inc.'s AGI research and reproduction facility in Yamasee, North South South Carolina. Apparently, someone who worked at the farm failed to properly secure an enclosure, allowing the female monkeys to launch an escapade for 2 weeks, largely entertained the 1,000 or so human primates who call Yemenis home. AGI, by comparison, houses about 10,000 primates on about 100 acres. What could go wrong? During their two-week caper, the monkeys were seen around town, though most stayed relatively close to their known food source. Residents were warned to keep windows and doors closed and not to feed or interact with the cuddly-looking scamps. These particular monkeys are curious and playful and pose no harm to people, according to the AGI. The company also said the monkeys were too young to have communicable diseases, which one animal welfare activist called misinformation. While monkeys are reputed to be a barrel of laughs, the 43 fugitives proved adept at opening a can of worms. Their escape brought unwanted attention to AGI by reminding animal welfare groups of the less than luxurious confines at the research facility. AGI has been fined for mishandling animals in the past. Republican Nancy Mace, Republican from South Carolina, a dedicated animal welfare advocate, has promised to uncover what happened. At her disposal are AGI internal documents cataloging incidents at the research center that were leaked to stop animal exploitation. Now, an animal rights group by a whistleblower. Sane, S-A-E-N, filed a formal complaint, including internal emails and reports, on Monday to the Department of Agriculture. In an email dated August 18, 2022, Christopher Brown, a director at AGI, reported he observed moldy food in two enclosures and no food in a third. In Building 7, he wrote, a vast majority of cages had minimal or no food whatsoever. Four monkeys had suffered severe weight loss. Several attempts to contact AGI for comment went unanswered. Greg Westergaard, AGI's chief executive, issued a statement in response to the complaint, noting that in a facility with thousands of monkeys, adverse incidents do occur in isolation and are promptly reported to the proper regulatory agencies. AGI culls monkeys as demand dictates and delivers them to pharmaceutical lab researchers and academic institutions around the world. With greater demand than supplies these days, it would seem imperative that alternative research measures be pursued with greater urgency. Economic considerations aside, sparing monkeys, dogs, and other animals from tortures of experimentation would be good for the human soul. To this end, Congress 2 years ago passed legislation to end the mandatory use of animals in research. Apparently, the Food and Drug Administration failed to implement or enforce the new law. So Mace and one of her Republican colleagues from Georgia, Representative Buddy Carter, are co-sponsoring another bill that is basically a directive for the FDA to do what it is told to do. This monkey business is no joke. If 43 monkeys descended upon my town, I think I'd pay attention to what they were trying to say. But that's just me. For the record, I'm still pulling for the missing four. Respect and hope they found a nice new low country plantation to colonize. In a letter to the editor, Barbara Benjamin from the Foothills writes, something to think about. Many years ago, my favorite history professor made a comment that applies more than ever. He said, every government is nothing more than a reflection of its society. Something to think about. The Arizona's men's basketball team will have a game today at 5:30 p.m., and it is taking place at Paradise Island, Bahamas. It'll be televised on TV on ESPN2 and on radio on 1290 AM and 107.5 AM. Again, that basketball game will be today at 5:30 PM. Pasco of the Star writes, despite slide, UA's love not shaken. Just a short stroll from the iconic pink towers of the Atlantis Resort is a Mayan temple replica sliced by a near-vertical waterslide in which giddy riders are funneled into a shark tank via see-through and ultimately protective tube. It's called the Leap of Faith. Caleb Love had a chance to take that plunge this week to maybe even metaphorically break the spell of two straight performances that went underwater. But he and roommate Troy Townsend had better things to do. "We're both asleep while everyone else was out there on the water slide," Love said. Sitting next to UA coach Tommy Lloyd and Townsend on the Battle for Atlantis interview podium Tuesday before the Wildcats face Davidson in their tournament opener Wednesday, Love drew a quick response on that one. "You guys didn't do the slide," Lloyd said, grinning. "I failed as a coach." Love didn't really need to in one sense. He has already taken a leap of faith, religious faith that is, with a little extra help from Mom. No water slides, no beach, no sunset meditations, just faith. "I've had time to reflect over these past few days," Love said. "I kind of get locked back in with my faith and having talks with my mom. She's been my backbone and my source of comfort, and she's kind of helped me with that. I'm just ready to go out there and hoop." The Wildcats undoubtedly hope so. They are entering the Battle for Atlantis, coming off two straight losses at Wisconsin and against Duke at McHale Center Games when Love swam well behind his preseason All-American billing, averaging 10.3 points on 32% shooting over four games this season so far. Love averaged only 7 points and 6 rebounds against Wisconsin and Duke while making just 1 of 15 three-pointers. He also shot only 36% from two-point range and took just 4 combined three throws. He wasn't able to make an impact inside or outside as Love had hoped entering the season, but said those around him stood strong. "My teammates, my coaches support me every day, and they never wavered. Good game, bad shots, good shots. Turnover assist," Love said. "So I go out there and I'm going to play with confidence, confidence, and not put any pressure on myself." It would hardly be a surprise if there was self-imposed pressure. After all, Love was a preseason first-team All-American and returning from the NBA draft process last spring with the goal of helping his team and resume during a fifth season of college basketball. Also, Love was the only returning starter of a team ranked number 10 to start the season. All eyes were on him, but Love said he didn't change. "I didn't put pressure on myself," Love said. "I've played with pressure all my life. When you think about it, in the grand scheme of things, I'm playing basketball, and that's just all it is. Putting pressure on myself is only going to hurt me or hinder me. So it's just go out there and have fun playing as hard as I can, doing whatever the team needs." It hasn't been all the same on the court for Love, though. For one thing, defenses have been focusing on him more than ever this season, deploying a variety of tricks. Love says setting better screens and moving better off the ball would help solve that problem. The other thing, Love said, has been his off-season focus on three-point shooting off the catch. That was understandable, considering that Love shot just 29.9% from three at North Carolina in 2023-24 to 33.2% last season, but needed even more efficiency to help his NBA stock. But while he aimed for all those threes, Love's proven ability to drive to the basket grew rusty. His two-point shooting has dropped from 50.2% last season to 45.5% this season, while those three throws he shot over the previous two games are actually the only four he shot all season. "What you focus on more is what you're probably going to do more, and that's been my focus, the three-point shot," Love said. "I think I've shot probably too many instead of playing inside out, so it's trying to get downhill more." I've done great in the past doing that, so I've got to get back to that and work my way out. My shot's got to fall. I'm not worried about that. Neither is Lloyd. The UA expressed support for Love at Wisconsin after the Duke game and again in Tuesday's press conference. Lloyd, it appears, has taken a leap of faith, too. I love Caleb, Lloyd said. Caleb's teammates love Caleb, and I'm not worried. Caleb's going to come out, and he could play out of his mind the next 3 days. If he doesn't play out of his mind the next few days, we're going to keep going forward. So there's no concern on my end. If Caleb's playing well is what's going to stand between us and being a good team, I feel pretty good, because ultimately he's going to play great. I like the security of that feeling. In Arizona football, Tatero McMillan's illustrious career at Arizona has come down to one final Saturday afternoon at Arizona Stadium. Arguably the greatest wide receiver in UA football history will play his last game in Tucson as the Wildcats look to salvage their disappointing season with a win over their rival, red-hot Arizona State. When it's all said and done, one could argue McMillan as one of four faces on Arizona football's Mount Rushmore. The numbers speak for themselves. McMillan's 3,355 career receiving yards ranks first in university history. McMillan set the record on Saturday in Arizona's loss to TCU and passed Bobby Wade. Arizona's wide receivers coach McMillan is the only Wildcat in the top 10 of Arizona's career receiving yards leaders to play three seasons at the UA. Everyone else had four. I was extremely happy, Wade said of McMillan, passing him for the Arizona receiving record. It was satisfying for sure. It was something that was a goal we set when we first got here. You don't make a lot of promises as a coach, but that was one. I promised him we'd get done regardless of the record, whatever else is going on. McMillan said working with Wade has been a blessing to be under his wing and for him to show me the ropes about the game. Arizona quarterback Noah Fifta, McMillan's longtime teammate since middle school, said McMillan deserves Arizona's all-time receiving record more than anybody. Obviously, week in and week out, he's the best player on the field, and he continues to show it since he has put on the Arizona uniform, Fifta said. That game, which is the Territorial Cup and Senior Day, Arizona State, which is ranked number 4, will play the U of A, and it will be at Arizona Stadium. You can watch it on Fox TV or listen to it at 1290 AM or 107.5 FM. The game is this Saturday at 1:30 PM. The food section has a recipe for chicken verde chili. With Thanksgiving coming up, I'm sure you'll have some leftover turkey breast, and you might want to use that instead. Hatch chilies are beloved for their unique smoky flavor and sneaky heat. Anaheim or Poblano chilies can be used in a pinch if you can't find Hatch chilies. This chili serves 6 people. The ingredients are 2 tablespoons olive oil, 1 large yellow onion diced, 15 ounces roasted Hatch chilies, roughly chopped seeds and stems discarded, 1 jalapeno pepper stemmed, seeded, and diced, 4 cloves garlic minced, 4 cups chicken broth, 1 pound chicken breast tenderloin, 1 teaspoon kosher salt plus more to taste, 1 teaspoon ground cumin, 1 teaspoon dried oregano, 2 15.5-ounce cans cannelli beans drained and rinsed, one cup chopped cilantro, the juice of 2 limes, sour cream, diced avocados, sliced green onions for serving. Directions: heat the olive oil in a large pot or Dutch oven over medium heat. Add onion and jalapeno and cook for 10 minutes until the peppers are softened and the onions are translucent. Stir in the garlic and cook for 1 minute until fragrant. Place the cooked onions and pepper and garlic in a blender with the roasted hatch chilies. Puree until it's well combined and smooth. Place the pureed peppers and onions back into the pot and add the chicken broth, chicken tenderloins, salt, cumin, and oregano. Stir to combine, then reduce and heat to low, cover and simmer for 20 minutes. Remove the chicken from the pot, and when cool enough to touch, shred with your fingers or two forks and add back to the pot. Stir in the beans, chopped cilantro, and lime juice. Taste and season with more salt if needed. Serve in bowls topped with sour cream, cilantro, green onion, and sliced avocado, or whatever toppings you like. You may want to serve that chili with some homemade cornbread. The ingredients for cornbread are 1 1/4 cup all-purpose flour, 3/4 cup yellow cornmeal, 1/4 cup sugar, 2 teaspoons baking powder, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 cup milk, 1/4 cup vegetable oil, and 1 egg beaten. Preheat your oven to 400 degrees, grease a 8 or 9 inch pan. Combine the dry ingredients, stir in milk, oil, and egg, and mix just until dry ingredients are moistened. Pour the batter into the prepared pan and cook until light golden brown, about 20 to 25 minutes. A toothpick or knife tip inserted into the center should come out clean. Today will be partly cloudy in the morning and will become overcast during the afternoon. We'll have a high around 75 degrees with winds light and variable. Tonight, it will be mostly cloudy skies and will become partly cloudy after midnight with a low of 51 degrees, winds light and variable. Tomorrow, there will be intervals of clouds and sunshine with a high of 74 degrees. Perfect weather to go walking after your Thanksgiving meal. That's it for today. I wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving, and I hope the Wildcats win the game. Go Wildcats!